Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Our musical trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one, it was on this very day back in 1966 in Beverly Hills, California, that a well-known surf rock singer from California crashed his car near Dead Man's Curve, which was the name of one of this singer's hits just a couple of years earlier. He suffered severe head injuries in this crash and was in a coma for nearly 2 months. What was the name of this surf rock singer's group? Was it A, the Beach Boys, B, the Safaris, C, Jan and Dean, or D, the Ventures? And question number two, it was on this day back in 1954 that Bill Haley and the Comets recorded what many consider to be the first rock and roll song. The song was released a year later in the movie Blackboard Jungle. So, what was the name of this song? Hint, here's an instrumental cover of this song. Sound familiar? So what's the name of this song? Is it A, Jailhouse Rock? Is it B, Maybelline? Is it C, Great Balls of Fire? Or is it D, Rock Around the Clock? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of April the 12th. Well, it was on this day back in 1742 that George Friedrich Handel's Messiah was first performed publicly in Dublin, Ireland, 1742. Handel was a German, later British, Baroque composer who spent the bulk of his career in London, becoming well known for his operas, oratorios, anthems, and organ concertos. And it was just 17 years after that premier performance of his Messiah, 1759, also on this very day, that George Friedrich Handel died, 1759. And it was also on this day back in 1999 that Tammy Wynette's body was exhumed and an autopsy performed in Nashville at the request of her husband, George Ritchie. Our country music article today addresses the questions, why was it done and what were the results? It's an article entitled, Wynette Autopsy Results Announced. This is written by Shannon Wayne Turner on the 20th of May, 1999, in CMT.com. Nashville, Tennessee, following an autopsy that was performed on April the 14th, it was announced today that Tammy Wynette died a year ago of heart failure, possibly brought on by complications from a chronic blood clotting condition. Metro Medical Examiner Dr. Bruce Levy met with reporters to reveal the results of an autopsy that was performed on Wynette on April the 14th, just over a year after the First Lady of Country Music died at age 55 on April 6, 1998. The autopsy was performed at the request of Wynette's widow, George Ritchie, after her daughters filed a $50 million wrongful death lawsuit in early April against Ritchie and Wynette's physician, Dr. Wallace Marsh. The suit claimed that the two men caused her death by failing to closely monitor her fragile condition and inappropriately administering her medication. Ritchie was later dismissed as a defendant in the suit, although it is still pending against Dr. Marsh. While the cause of death was initially listed as a blood clot in the lung, Dr. Levy said today that in fact there was no evidence of an existing clot at the time of Wynette's death. However, because of the chronic nature of her condition, there was significant evidence of previous clots which compromised her lung arteries. The restricted arteries caused pressure on the right side of Wynette's heart, which in turn eventually led to the cardiac arrhythmia that killed her. Dr. Levy commented, "If I were asked to testify in court whether I'd classify this as a natural death, yes, I would. I'm very satisfied, based upon the autopsy, that we have as good a picture as we're ever going to have about what medically caused her death. Tammy, Stand By Your Man, Wynette, died of natural causes." It was also on this very day, back in 1958, that Van Cliburn of Kilgore, Texas, earned first prize in the Soviet Union's Tchaikovsky International Piano Contest in Moscow. He was the first American to win the award, and this is Van Cliburn playing Tchaikovsky's Concerto No. 1 with the RCA Symphony. As an intro to our classical music news, it's an article entitled "Looking Back at the Pianist Who Conquered Russia." Texas-born Van Cliburn became an unlikely cultural ambassador during the Cold War. This is published in Playbill.com by Ben Finane on July 26, 2018. At the height of the Cold War in 1958, a young, tall drink of water from Texas loped into the lion's den of Moscow and won the piano prize in the International Tchaikovsky Competition. He won on Russian concertos, Tchaikovsky No. 1, Rachmaninoff No. 3, in front of a group of largely Russian judges that included Kabalevsky, Kachaturian, Richter, and Zimbalist. And Shostakovich chaired the competition. Reminiscent of rock star performances of a bygone era by Liszt, Paganini, and Paderewski, women at the competition wept and fainted at Van Cliburn's playing. The crowd was on his side. The judges were on his side. Nikita Khrushchev embracing him after the concert in a great bear hug was on his side. Looking back, what's striking is not that Van Cliburn won in Russia, but that he won the Russians over. When he returned home, Cliburn was an instant hero. He made the cover of Time magazine, "The Texan Who Conquered Russia." The 23-year-old was given a ticker tape parade in New York City. America had never bestowed such an honor on a classical musician, and never will again. The reason for that is not the low self-esteem of classical music in our country today, nor the fragmentation of the media, nor the fractured nature of our breathless, cockeyed news cycle, nor the fact that only opera singers reach diva status these days, but rather that the celebration of Van Cliburn as hero on this side of the Atlantic had nothing to do with classical music. America loves a winner, and 6 months after the launch of Sputnik, the country was positively desperate for one. Had Van Cliburn attended Moscow's inaugural blintz eating contest and polished off more plates of pancakes than the Russians, he may well still have garnered a parade upon his return home, at least in his native Texas, and time wouldn't have had to change its cover line. Cliburn's artistry was appropriated as a victory in the Cold War. It would presage the moon landing and Rocky IV. Capitalism over communism. We won. Let's throw this patriot, this warrior, a parade. God bless America. But revisit the reaction in Moscow, the weeping, the embraces, the adoration. These aren't the reactions of people who have lost. The Russians were moved by the unassuming Americans' considered yet intuitive interpretations of their music, of Tchaikovsky, the greatest of Russian composers, of Rachmaninoff's vital third concerto. How many Muscovites dwelling behind the Iron Curtain had seen a non-Russian pianist, an American pianist, an American pianist who had learned the great Russian concertos so intimately and played them so beautifully? Moscow launched Van Cliburn into space but could not sustain the pianist's burgeoning career, which fell to earth and never recovered. In an obituary written in the Washington Post, Tim Page noted that Cliburn relinquished his crown while he was still a young man, and his life may be seen as a long study in anticlimax. In the New York Times, Anthony Tomasini wrote, "In the late 1950s, this babyface, teetotaling, church-going, wholesome Texan had fit the times. Van Cliburn shone when the stars aligned in an unscripted moment and was victorious. He didn't possess the temperament of discipline for a concert pianist, and he was no cold warrior. He was not our greatest pianist, but something far nobler, our greatest ambassador for classical music. Through his recordings of Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff, through the Van Cliburn International Piano Competition, which has continued every 4 years in Fort Worth for a half century, Cliburn exposed millions of Americans to classical music, many for the first time." John Coltrane's My One and Only Love introduces our jazz music news. It's an article entitled John Coltrane Biography, Saxophonist, Musician, Composer, 1926 to 1967, as published in biography.com. John Coltrane was an acclaimed American saxophonist, bandleader, and composer, becoming an iconic figure of 20th century jazz with albums like Giant Steps, My Favorite Things, and A Love Supreme. John Coltrane was born on September 23, 1926, in Hamlet, North Carolina. During the 40s and 50s, he continued to develop his craft as a saxophonist and composer, working with famed musician bandleaders Dizzy Gillespie, Duke Ellington, and Miles Davis. Coltrane turned the jazz world on its head with technically marvelous, innovative playing that was thrillingly dense and fluid in its understanding of the genre. His virtuosity and vision could be heard on his albums. He died from liver cancer at 40 years old on July 17, 1967, in Huntington, Long Island, New York. In 1957, he worked with pianist Thelonious Monk, while also developing as a bandleader and solo recording artist, heralded by the release of several albums. At the start of a new decade, Coltrane made his debut on Atlantic Records with the groundbreaking Giant Steps, 1960, penning all of the material himself. By this time, Coltrane had nurtured a distinctive sound defined in part by an ability to play several notes at once amid wondrous cascades of scales, dubbed in 1958 by critic Ira Gitler as a sheets of sound technique. Coltrane reportedly described it this way: "I start in the middle of a sentence and move both directions at once." A Love Supreme, 1965, is arguably Coltrane's most globally acclaimed record. The succinct four-suite album, a big seller that went gold decades later, is noted not only for Coltrane's astounding technical vision, but for its nuanced spiritual explorations and ultimate transcendence. The work was nominated for 2 Grammys and is considered a hallmark album by jazz historians around the world. Growing up in nearby High Point, North Carolina, Coltrane was surrounded by music as a child. His father, John R. Coltrane, worked as a tailor, but had a passion for music, playing several instruments. The younger Coltrane's early influences included jazz legends like Count Basie and Lester Young. By his teens, Coltrane had picked up the alto saxophone and displayed immediate talent. Family life took a tragic turn in 1939 with the passing of Coltrane's father. Financial struggles defined this period for Coltrane, and eventually his mother, Alice, and other family members moved to New Jersey in the hopes of having an improved life. Coltrane remained in North Carolina until he graduated from high school. In 1943, he too moved north, specifically to Philadelphia, to make a go of it as a musician. But with the country in the throes of war, he was called to duty and enlisted in the Navy. Upon his return to civilian life in the summer of 1946, Coltrane landed back in Philadelphia, where he teamed up with a number of jazz bands. John Coltrane wrote and recorded a considerable amount of material over the final 2 years of his life, in which his work was described as avant-garde, steeped in poignant spirituality for some, while spurned by others. In 1967, he died at only 40 years old from liver cancer in New York. His legacy? A voracious reader noted for his gentleness, Coltrane had an immense impact on the music world. He revolutionized jazz with his innovative, demanding technique while showing a deep reverence for sounds from other locales that included Africa, Latin America, the Far East, and South Asia. Having received a 1981 Grammy posthumously, in 1992 Coltrane was given the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award as well. In 2007, the Pulitzer Prize Board also awarded the musician a special citation. Coltrane's work continues to be an integral part of the sonic landscape and a major inspiration for newer generations of artists. And in music research and technology, we have this article entitled "Striking a Chord." This is published in Time Magazine, 15th of April, 2019, and written by Claire Nugent. Entertaining mosquitoes with music by dubstep artist Skrillex made them suck less blood and breed more slowly. A study published March 25th found. Here are some more musical marvels. Subway symphonies. In 2003, London's Transport Authority piped classical music into some stations in a bid to reduce crime. Within 18 months, robberies had fallen by a third, and assaults on staff by a quarter. Tuning up. Listening to uplifting dance music may help you get over a cold. A 2008 study by researchers in Germany said 50 minutes of the music cut volunteers' level of the stress hormone cortisol and boosted antibodies. And finally, canine chorus. Reggae and soft rock music both help reduce stress levels in dogs. Per a 2017 study from the University of Glasgow, when those genres were played, dogs had lower heart rates and spent more time lying down. The Rolling Stones Satisfaction introduces our rock and pop music news. It's an article entitled, Secrets of the Stones Set List. Ahead of a U.S. tour, the band breaks down a recent London gig. This is written by Patrick Doyle and published in the April 2019 issue of Rolling Stone magazine. Number 1, Street Fighting Man from 1968. Early in the tour, the band kicked off with Sympathy for the Devil, but then Mick Jagger, who makes the set list, switched to this explosive political rocker for the rest of the run. It's just felt good, says Keith Richards. I don't know if there's another one that can top it. Then at number 4, Beast of Burden from 1978. They soundcheck this song all the time and are puzzled why Jagger rarely puts it in the set. I'll look at the set list and go, "Hey, Mick, we just rehearsed this," says Wood. He doesn't answer. "It's like a tease," adds Richard. "I wish we did it more, but it's up to Mick. He doesn't feel like it." Number 5, Honky Tonk Women from 1969. Honky tonk can be really hard to play, man, says Richard. When it's right, it's really right. There's something about the starkness of the beginning you really have to have down, and the tempo has to be just right. It's a challenge, but I love it. Number 7, Symphony for the Devil, 1968. Richard calls this epic such a bizarre thing to play. It's incredible fun, but there's all these gaps. Ronnie and I don't even play until the bridge. Pleased to meet ya. Number 8, Gimme Shelter from 1969. Richard's layered several guitar parts on the original recording. Playing it live is his biggest challenge. That beginning is so eerie. Sometimes in a stadium you start to hear echoes, he says. I'm never sure if I'm the right volume. I'm always a bit anxious about it. And finally, number 9, I Can't Get No Satisfaction from 1965. It's the riff of all time, Richard says. Despite playing it consistently since 1965, he hasn't tired of it. I'm still finding how to tighten it up. Bassist Daryl Jones and I are working on the rhythm and, lately, slightly different ideas to make it snappier and better. Bach's Concerto in A for Oboe introduces our local music news. It's an article entitled, Back to the Baroque Weekend. That's coming up April 20th through the 21st on radio station WCPE 89.7 FM. This is as reported in Crescendo, the online magazine of WCPE. During the time of the Baroque era, from 1600 to 1750, Western music reached levels of harmonic complexity and instrumental virtuosity never known before. We'll explore this fascinating period through some of the best-known works by Bach, Handel, and Vivaldi, plus some delightful pieces you may not have heard before by Telemann, Albinoni, Purcell, the Scarlatti family, and more. So give a listen April 20th through the 21st to WCPE 89.7 FM on your dial for Baroque music. So how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our second question, it was on this day back in 1954 that Bill Haley and the Comets recorded what many consider to be the first rock and roll song. The song was released a year later in the movie Blackboard Jungle. What was the name of this song? And I played an instrumental cover of the song as a hint. Was it A, Jailhouse Rock, B, Maybelline, C, Great Balls of Fire, or D, Rock Around the Clock? Correct answer. Answer D, Rock Around the Clock. And the answer to our first question, it was on this day back in 1966 in Beverly Hills, California, that a well-known surf music singer from California crashed his car near Dead Man's Curve, which was the name of one of the singer's hits just a couple years earlier. He suffered severe head injuries and was in a coma for 2 months. What was the name of this beach music singer's group? Was it A, the Beach Boys, B, the Safaris, C, Jan and Dean, or D, the Ventures? Correct answer is answer C, Jan and Dean, Dead Man's Curve. Well, not all Jan and Dean songs were darkly prophetic about risky youth behavior. They also sang about risky geriatric behavior. So, let's close out today's program with another hit by this same surf rock group, Jan and Dean, The Little Old Lady from Pasadena.
It's the little old lady from Pasadena.
The little old lady from Pasadena.
Has
a pretty little flower bed of white gardenia.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review, and as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Content of this program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review, readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in the TRRS website, TriangleReadingService.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me, Randy Thompson, at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.